What do you do when life happens? Get catalytic. I am your host, Cheryl Hirsch Kramer, welcoming you to the premiere episode of Catalytic on BBS Radio Station 1. I am delighted to be with BBS. I'm delighted to be with you, whether you're live or whether you're listening to the archive. Thank you for joining us. We know you have many choices for your entertainment time, and you chose to be with us, and thank you for that. You're going to like this show. One of my all-time favorite radio guests is joining me tonight. His name is Dr. Dean Schrock. If you don't know him, let me give you a brief intro. Dr. Schrock, as director of mind-body medicine for Physician Management Group of 40 cancer centers, taught and researched a wellness program that improves survival with cancer. He's the best-selling author of Doctor's Orders Go Fishing, Why Love Heals, Mind, Body, Spirit Medicine, and Living and Thriving, a Mind, Body, Spirit program for wellness. In addition, he co-authored the chapter on Mind, Body, Medicine in Dr. Andrew Weil's 2014 text, Integrative Oncology, and is one of the spiritual teachers interviewed in the 2014 international best-selling book, The Power of the Heart. And not only that, he's a good guy. I've known Dean for several years now. I don't remember how many years it is. Because I've had him as a guest on my show, it was one of the influences that helped me save my dog's life when she was diagnosed with terminal cancer 2 years ago. We did not do surgery. We did not do chemo. We did not do radiation. We did holistic veterinary care. And more important, I used what he taught me. I included the power of love. My dog's tumors were gone in a month. We had 2 more years together, cancer-free. She died this past June, and because I learned things from Dean, I know that's a lot of why I was able to save her life. I am so grateful, Dean. I can never thank you enough. How are you, my friend?
I'm good, and it's so good to hear you and your voice so strong. You sound great.
Yeah, I've done pretty much nothing this summer. I've been a caregiver for 8.5 years, and I decided I need to do this for myself for a change. So thank you for saying that. I appreciate that.
Oh, you're welcome. You sound good.
Thanks. So do you. You always sound good, though. So we're going to talk about the power of the heart. That is the name of our show tonight, The Power of the Heart. And first of all, how would you define for yourself, what is the power of the heart?
Oh, boy. It includes numbers of qualities. Primarily, I would say joy, love, peace, truth. But there's an aspect of us that goes beyond, I think, what we can really understand and measure scientifically. And a very special young man, his name is Baptiste de Pop, had a very life-changing experience where after watching Eckhart Tolle and the Oprah Winfrey special and hearing Eckhart ask people, what does life want from you? Not even just what do you think your life purpose is and what do you want, what does life want from you? And so he took this very seriously and went into a meditation where he was just moved beyond any other kind of experience he'd ever had and given tremendous insights and asked to do something he'd never even considered doing before, had no experience doing, and that was to really look into the power of the heart and to create a film about the power of the heart, and certainly including this power that we can go within and access an inner wisdom that has given him great guidance. And certainly I can say in my own professional and personal experience, that's one of the qualities of the heart, to be sure. I encourage people to investigate and develop, and whether we call it intuition or this inner wisdom and guidance, it's very real, very meaningful, and maybe I would even go so far as to say no other talent or aspect of our being that may have more meaning or benefit than developing this ability to go within and gain insights into all of life's concerns.
For people who have not developed their intuitive gifts, and would you agree with me that we all have that power to be intuitive?
Oh, yes. It's a part of who we are. It's not like it's something odd and somehow related to New Age thinking or worse. It's a natural part of who we are. It's a natural part of our intelligence. And I believe, in the way that I understand it, even though I'm trained scientifically and understand the importance of doing research, I think that it actually has more to offer in many respects than what we do scientifically and with controlled research.
Well, I'm glad we're talking about this. It's not often that you get to hear a researcher talking about intuition, and I appreciate the opportunity to discuss this with you. I would love to do a whole show on developing intuition with you. Maybe we could do that sometime. But for people who have not consciously worked on developing their intuition, can you give them a little start to get them into this?
You know, I think that one of the ways to say it, which may surprise your audience initially, is to really pay attention to what brings them the greatest joy in their lives. I honestly believe that when we're connected to what brings us the greatest enthusiasm, joy, passion, it's a way of honestly connecting with our heart or with this inner wisdom. And I even remember reading Neil Donald Walsh's books, the Conversations with God series in particular. And a number of quotes stand out for me, like, one, passion is God's way of saying hi or wanting to say hi. It's just simply a part of who we are, joy, enthusiasm, passion. It's just part of, again, who we are at the deepest level, and it's a matter of accessing it by learning to quiet our logical mind. And maybe a good example of how that was experienced was with Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor in her book, My Stroke of Insight. And I'm sure some of your audience knows about her. She's a neuroanatomist, so she's a brain scientist. And she had a stroke, unfortunately, or fortunately, perhaps, in what she learned from this. And her left brain hemisphere was compromised, so now she was experiencing reality as such with her right brain and discovered that our different hemispheres know very different realities. And at the core, she said, of our right brain's perception, that the best way to describe this experience of at the core who we really are is the feeling of joy. So I think, again, that when we are doing what we love most and best and we feel that, it's a way of confirming that this is really what we certainly could do. And the probability is that it will be make us happier and healthier.
I can confirm that. As you know, I had a very significant stroke in March of 2012. I had read Dr. Taylor's book before the stroke. So not that I thought about it while I was recovering from the stroke. Thinking was not one of my best games at that point. But later I picked up the book and I reread it to the best I could read at that moment. What I've noticed with myself is when the brain doesn't work the way it used to work, you have a choice. You can either not be present or you could go into the heart. And I chose to go into the heart. And it's one of the best journeys I've ever taken. In many ways, the stroke has been terrific for me. I've learned and grown so much from it. And it may sound weird to people listening. I'm grateful for it. Does that make sense to you, Dean?
Well, it does make sense to me. You know, one of the experiences I've had for many, many years, and I've also learned in working with many other professionals dealing with cancer, like Carl Simonton and Bernie Siegel, is that crises, certainly including dealing with cancer, can actually lead to our lives becoming richer and fuller as a result of the experience. And one of the ways I experience that very definitely myself is how I believe it leads people to reprioritize their lives when we're faced with a life-threatening experience. Although some people can experience it and become very bitter at the other extreme, and very commonly at some point, people can actually say cancer was the best thing that ever happened because now they started to think and do more of what they would really like to do in their lives. And that's one of the things I would do when I would teach cancer patients and their families is ask them, how do you want to spend the time you have left? And not that you have a little time, that's not why I'm here, is to somehow sneak in that, you know, your doctors want me to tell you your time's limited. But whether you have a little time or a lot of time, how do you want to spend the time you have left? And it's amazing to see how people can really start to think about this and better yet, actually start to do something about it.
Well, this seems like a good time to ask you that question. I told you I was going to ask you. I have a neighbor, and we've lived nearby each other for many, many years now. We've seen each other walking our dogs when my dog was still with me, and she's had various dogs over the years. So she knew that my dog had been diagnosed with terminal cancer in April of 2013. And she told me right away she was going to die because all the other dogs in the neighborhood who had cancer were dying. She blamed it on the pesticides. And I didn't believe that Layla was going to die. It just didn't seem like that needed to happen necessarily. Even though she had terminal cancer, the vet gave her 6 weeks to live, I didn't necessarily believe that was true. So I started avoiding seeing this woman, not because I didn't like her, but because I didn't want to be around the negativity. Well, as life would happen, Mary developed cancer herself. And I learned this one day when walking the dog, and I talked to her for a few minutes. So after Layla passed away, I wanted to offer her everything I've learned that I used with Layla to help save her life. I said, can I have a couple of minutes of your time to introduce the protocol? And she's going through chemo, so she was tired. But I said, I promise you I'll make it short. And I told her what I'm doing now, how I'm teaching this, how I'm sharing this, how I'm coaching this, how I did this with Layla. And she looked at me, and her response was very interesting to me. She said, you know, Cheryl, my father had a doctorate in mathematics, and he told me that everything has to be logical in life. What you're saying to me is not logical, and I can't accept it. Now, she had seen my dog for 2 years. She knew my dog wasn't dying. She actually asked me one day if I'd gotten another dog who looked just like my dog. And I said, no, this is still her. She had a very difficult time. So she had reality staring her in the face, and she couldn't connect with it. What would you say to somebody who says, I can't accept reality?
Honestly, I would probably just let it go. And you know, there's a story I tell to people where the answer or the punchline is, you may be right. If you want to, I'll actually tell the story. It probably wouldn't make your audience laugh.
Good.
Okay, so the story goes that, you know how many interview formats, programs there are now on television? It used to be, I can picture him, I can't think of his name right now, but even before Oprah Winfrey, there just were these wonderful talk show programs, but then at some point, it's like there was this proliferation, and God only knows what they would talk about, who the guests would be, and so forth. Anyhow, I was using the clicker, as my wife calls it, the remote, and on commercials in between, you know, I'm clicking around, and I came across this interview show, and the guest was a fella who, it was his 100th birthday that day, Cheryl, and the gist of the interview wasn't to what do you attribute your longevity. And again, God only knows what he might have said. But without hesitation, the old man said that it's because I've never had an argument with anyone in my life. Well, the interviewer was positively stupefied by this response. In fact, he asked the question again because he was sure he didn't really hear the man say that it was because he'd never had an argument. So he asked him again, and again the old man said, yes, it's because I've never had an argument. So then the interviewer started to use all this logic. You can't tell me that's true. And so he did this logic. He said, okay, now listen. 100 years times 365 days times 24 hours times 60 minutes and so forth. You can't tell me that in all that time you've never had an argument with anyone in your life. And the old man said, you may be right.
Yeah.
And the point is, what did the old man have to gain by arguing with someone who just wasn't ready, for whatever reason, to accept the old man's experience, or I could even say wisdom? And so, honestly, I think we need to respect our individual differences and perspectives and perceptions and let it go. And if anything, say a prayer for them. God bless you. I hope this works out for you. And honestly, sure, I would have avoided the argument if, in fact, she were interested in some references for other experiences, perhaps more scientific. Certainly there were things that you may not have known about that she could check. But in my experience, many times, I would say even most of the time, people are just closed to other possibilities, unfortunately.
Well, I allowed her to be where she was. I thought that was the most respectful thing I could do for her in the minute. And I said, can I pray for you? And she said, I don't believe in prayer. And I said, okay, can I visualize you as being happy and healthy? And she says, yes, that you can do. And I saw her today. She looks pretty good. So for whatever reason, she looks better than she looked when we had this conversation. I like that.
Yeah, it must have been you.
I hope so. You might be right. You may be right. So for people who don't understand how the act of loving somebody can actually help them live a longer, more productive life, can you explain the scientific basis of that?
Well, right. That was the conclusion of my research. As you know, I was director of Mind Body Medicine, and I developed a wellness program where primarily we were encouraging people to develop a will to live, bring more joy and meaning into your life. And I think common sense for most people is that if people have a stronger will to live, they're likely to fare better than those who are pessimistic or worse, you know, really desperate and despondent and depressed, etc., and withdrawing from life. So I was encouraging them to engage in life to be certain. And interestingly, in attempting to do that, I found quite by surprise that these people found it too selfish. That really threw me, because here I was, one of their doctors, as part of their treatment for cancer, encouraging them to do more of what they really love to do. And I was thinking, hey, I'm giving you this license to steal. This is great. Could you imagine your doctor telling you as part of treatment to do more of what you love? But again, they were so conditioned to think that everyone and everything else comes first that it was too selfish for them to really do. So I had to get over that and deal with that, but then also explain, and I think more in terms of common sense, like when you're busy doing what you like to do, you tend to forget your aches and pains, that in fact, this is your experience. And so in my research, when they weren't doing what I wanted them to do to develop this will to live, I had to explain for me and for my research, okay, so what made the difference? And the editors of the journal who asked to publish my research asked if I would be willing to give my clinical opinion, which is usually something you don't do. You only cite original primary research. But I was glad to offer my opinion, and it was because I experienced clinically as I went around to these different cancer centers that what helped these people the most was not any specific coping skill I taught them, not guided imagery or stress management as such, but because I listened and I cared and I was supported. And initially that really threw me. I didn't understand that. But then it was just something that became really important to me to understand how feeling listened to and cared for and supported and loved. Like Dean Ornish concluded in his research with heart disease, when you feel loved and cared for, he said there's nothing more important that you can do. But how does that translate into remission from cancer or heart disease? So that's why I went on to write Why Love Heals, and concluded in my research that, it was because people felt loved and cared for that they lived longer. And then since writing that book, publishing it in 2009, I've had many more experiences and more evidence to support why it is that love really is healing, even though I'm sure many in your audience would acknowledge, it's just intuitive. Of course it would be healing, although I certainly appreciate from a scientific perspective that we need a little more evidence somehow to really support that and be able to offer that as part of cancer treatment.
Could you share with us one or two stories of patients you worked with, keeping their anonymity, of course, what happened when you saw them, how advanced was their cancer, and what the outcome was after you worked with them?
Yeah, well, you know, I worked with thousands of people. The one story I tend to remember because it was rather extreme in terms of his original diagnosis and prognosis when I met him, and then how he was able to turn it around so dramatically. But his name was Bud, and I know that he would be thrilled for me to give his real name, even though Bud wasn't his technically, you know, correct name. But Bud, when I first met him, he was in a wheelchair and in obvious discomfort. He really was in pain, and I had access to his medical chart. Plus, I was told by his oncologist he probably didn't have 2 months to live. And that very night, I was starting a new series of classes teaching them about things they could do for themselves to make their treatments go better, reduce side effects, and so forth. And I just felt obligated to at least tell him and his wife this is what was happening, and we would like him to do it, but pretty certain in my mind that he was just not up to it. So I was surprised when he came to the first class, and even more surprised when I was talking about guided imagery, like self-hypnosis, that you could actually imagine and tell yourself that your body's going to function in a healthier way and literally increase the probability that it will. And he leaned forward in his wheelchair, and he was mad. You mean to tell me I can just imagine my cancer away or whatever? And it was interesting then that I didn't respond, because numbers of people in the class responded based on what they knew and their experience and so forth. But now I was sure Bud wasn't coming back. One, because remember, again, he's in bad shape. But now he was mad at me. So he came back to all six classes, Cheryl. And at the end of the classes, he came up to me and he said, I want to buy a new boat. Now, remember this. Let's be really practical and honest. The guy's not supposed to live maybe two more weeks, and he's got these huge medical expenses, and he wants to go buy a new boat. So what would you say to Bud? Honest. What would you say to Bud?
Well, because it's me, I would say go buy a boat, but most people wouldn't say that.
Well, in my position, I didn't think it was appropriate for me to say yes or no, but obviously he knew a lot about what I taught, and largely a message, one of the messages was live like you're going to live. But I'm still thinking very practically around, you know, you have a family and all these expenses. Is that really what you want to do? And as you might imagine, though, Bud and his wife Shirley went out and bought that boat, and they said it was the best summer of their lives. Great story for me. I'm really moved me. It still moves me to remember how well he loved to go fish, literally. And even more, he so took to his guided imagery, we actually created an audio cassette, or I did, where I had these exercises where people would imagine themselves well. And Bud listened to that tape every day, even if he were out on the boat or ended up in the hospital for whatever. He always listened to his tape. Anyhow, eventually Bud did die. They buried him with his audio cassette player and tape. And they will never, ever think other than some of the things they learned, but the key is, of course, then to do it, to follow up and do it, that it made a huge difference in his quality of life. I would even say definitely quality of death, but certainly prolonged his life.
What a great story. Thank you for sharing that. That's just magnificent. So for somebody like that who was angry at what you were presenting, to shift into that whole different outcome, what an amazing experience for you to go through. Have you seen this frequently, that people do get angry before they decide to try a different way?
Well, I think sometimes people are more likely to hide it and just not come back to class rather than be outspoken like Bud was that night. So I don't know. Even prior to my work with cancer, I worked with strokes. And I used to joke that I was glad my desk was as wide as it was, because the general experience with having a stroke was that you went through, and managing the pain or any chronic pain experience, was that before people ever ended up seeing someone like me, they've probably gone through about 5 years of major medical kinds of treatments and approaches, and by the time they got to me, it was because their doctors, or somehow they came to believe it was all in their head, you know, the doctors are telling them this, or the idea is that it's not something that can be treated medically. And so here I had this image of the people coming in as I was explaining, say, guided imagery, like Bud. All I have to do is imagine my pain away. And after 5 years of going through what they likely had gone through, that they would have liked to have reached across my desk and slugged me for suggesting something so stupid. But I've had a lot of experience with this, and I know better, and I know the research. You know, as you said in my introduction, I co-authored the chapter on mind-body medicine in Dr. Andrew Weil's textbook, Integrative Oncology. And we have more than 160 scientific references in our chapter showing how people can manage their symptoms and otherwise affect the quality of their life, even though it's certainly not clear there's not enough research about extending life. There's a huge amount of evidence beyond all of my clinical experience that people can make a huge difference in their lives. They can do so much more to take control of their health and their life.
They really can. And I saw with my dog, who clearly didn't know about your work. I don't think she read any of your books. I doubt that she read Dr. Wild's book, you know what I'm saying? And she got well, and she stayed well, and she did not die of cancer. So this stuff does work. I'm here to tell you what you do is magnificent, and it's a beautiful service to humanity. I'm going to ask you a question I don't think I've ever asked you before. What is love to you?
I would say it is an all-pervasive energy that underlies and flows through everything. And I feel especially comfortable talking about it that way because of quantum physics research, and especially that of Dr. David Bohm, who talks about this quantum field that underlies all of physical reality. He even calls it a primary reality. And he called it one of complete harmony and order, and even an energy of love. He actually called it an energy of love. So whether we look at it from this physics perspective as an energy with the qualities of compassion and harmony and order, or metaphysically, and what the qualities of love are, it's certainly one of caring and kindness and compassion. And it's who we are, honestly, when, as I understand it, everything is manifesting from this quantum soup, and some unbelievably intelligent mind or source organizing this. And as we understand it physically, when consciousness is introduced, it goes from this no form of just potential energy to then being able to take on form and wave and particle form. It supports what I remember reading early on, how we create our own reality, and not really understanding that there's any scientific basis for it, but there seems to be real fact and science too, that our thoughts and our feelings, in fact, have a lot to do with whatever we experience in life, and I would even say the creation of all of life in our collective experience and all of our thoughts and feelings.
You know, there's so many places we could go right now in this conversation. The one thing I want to offer you right now, would you like to take a break for a couple of minutes, or do you want to keep going?
Oh, I'm good.
I'm good, too. Let's keep going. So as you're talking, and I'm remembering my story, and when I had that bolt of genius when my dog was diagnosed with cancer, I'd been through a lot, as you know, the previous years. In 2011, I went through many, many deaths at one time of loved ones and many traumas, many losses, things like that over a six-month period. And I didn't have time to heal from one before the next one would hit. And then I had the stroke the following year, which pretty much put me on my back for a long time. So when my dog developed terminal cancer in 2013, the vet diagnosed that the vet did holistic treatment with her. It's not that she didn't have veterinary care, but we didn't do the traditional extreme methods. I remember thinking to myself, well, if feeling unloved and unsupported destroyed my health in 2012, what would happen to Layla if I gave her all the love and the support that I wish I'd have gotten? And I didn't know who was going to work or not. It just felt like a place I needed to go to see what happened. I was stunned when the tumors were gone in a month. I never expected that. I saw the x-ray. They were big tumors. So for people listening to this, and they're thinking, how do I wrap my mind around what they're saying? I'm not lying to you guys, and neither is Dean. You know, this stuff does happen, and it doesn't happen infrequently. One of my neighbors said to me, it only happens to angels. I have a lot of interesting neighbors. You must come visit me sometime.
Hey, well, you know, what you're saying in one sense is unusual, but from another perspective, it really isn't at all. You know, being involved in science and statistics, if I said that there was something that 90 or more percent of all people did, would that be unusual? That would be the norm, but the biggest kind of norm. Well, guess what? 90-plus percent of the people, Americans at least, happen to believe in God and believe in prayer. In fact, the great majority of them pray regularly, and I would say unless they're crazy, they do it for a reason. They do it because they believe it works. And so there's no question in my mind, if we just look at our common shared experience, that praying for, and if you excuse the scientific language, we call it a deliberate intention technique. So whether it's guided image or self-hypnosis or affirmations or prayer, when you are deliberately focusing on what it is you want and also coming from your heart, and I could also cite other research how when you couple coming from your heart along with what you visualize, the great probability is you're going to affect the response. Now, the way I like to say it is we're going to increase the odds. I would never guarantee if you do any specific treatment that you're going to get well or cure a disease, but how would you like to increase your odds? And we certainly know about the placebo effect, which is all about beliefs and expectations. And if you don't control for people's beliefs and expectations in doing any study, the research is no good, because we know people's beliefs are that powerful. One-third of the time, people's beliefs are as powerful as any treatment. And the more serious the illness, the more extreme the treatment, the better the placebo effect works. So I'm not surprised for a lick. And knowing how much you loved your dog, and I'm looking at a book now that you've been talking about, this titled Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home by Rupert Sheldrake. So here's a biologist of some real repute talking about how there's no question that dogs and our pets and animals sense our thoughts and feelings. And you can't own a pet and not know that. So again, it makes great sense to me, but I give you all the credit in the world for, you know, loving the dog as well as you did. And not just that anyone who does this would automatically have the same response, but I'm saying the odds are certainly in your favor. You're going to improve the situation, again, whether it means quality of life or length of life. So good for you.
Well, thank you, and thank you for helping me. I wasn't consciously thinking of you when I developed the protocols that I used with her, but as we went along, I was thinking, yeah, I learned that from Dean Schrock, because, you know, at that point, my brain still wasn't necessarily healed enough to reference past interviews. But as we went along, I realized that what you were saying at the time did make a big impact upon me, and I credit you with a lot of what I did with Layla.
Yeah.
I'd like to share very briefly. Go ahead.
Yeah, so however I might have had some influence, I'm certainly so grateful. And now again, this Baptiste Depop, my new friend who wrote The Power of the Heart and interviewed so many people around the world, some of the greatest teachers like Maya Angelou and Deepak Chopra and Eckhart Tolle, asking them about how they understand people's thoughts and feelings and intentions in any way enhance people's lives. And to be included in that, I was certainly thrilled. And now that the book is in, even though it hasn't even been out a year, is in more than 80 countries and more than 20 languages, I'm so pleased that this kind of information is getting out there.
It so needs to be shared. And this probably is a good time to mention the retreat that you're going to be helping to facilitate next month. Could you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Baptiste, again, is the author of the book, The Power of the Heart. I told his story to open the show, and he went on to also be a co-producer of the film, which is really wonderful. There's no way you won't be moved big time in watching this movie, The Power of the Heart. Anyhow, I got to know him, obviously, because I was interviewed for the book and attended a number of screenings of the movie. And when he was visiting here earlier this year and we did a screening, he asked me if I would do a workshop with him, which I was very pleased. So, yes, next month, October 17th and 18th, here in Yahats, Oregon, here on the Oregon coast, it's beautiful, we're going to have a two-day weekend retreat where we're going to talk about the power of the heart and all of what he has learned in interviewing some of the greatest spiritual teachers around the world. And then my experience with certainly how love and the power of love and the heart can affect people's lives so dramatically. And I know one of the things he wants to talk about is the six steps to manifesting at the highest level. And so not only how we can understand the power of the heart, but how we can use it to bring a much greater joy and sense of inner stillness into our lives.
This sounds absolutely fabulous, and I'm sure we have listeners who are wondering, how do I get into this? So how do they get into this?
You catch a plane to Portland and drive 3 hours to the coast and join us. It's going to be great. But obviously you can just go out to Amazon and The Power of the Heart, or go out on the Internet and look up thepoweroftheheart.com, and you'll be inspired by the quality of the information and the product, the quality of the book, the quality of the film. I'm very, very pleased to be part of this.
So if people do want to join you in Oregon, is the information on the retreat posted on your website, on the other website? How can people read more about this?
Actually, my website, because someone had to manage it, and so I'm very blessed that I have some friends, including my wife, who set this up. And yes, if you go to deanschrock.com, and Schrock is spelled S-H-R-O-C-K, you can go to the events button, click, and in fact register for the retreat, or learn more about it at least. And we would love for you to join us. We expect a pretty good turnout. And it's just so fun at this point to share what I've learned after studying and working at this so long, and now to have someone like Baptiste, who brings a bigger, broader perspective to all of this. And certainly the way we'll teach it won't be about cancer. It's going to be about how you can really go about accessing the power and potential, an unlimited potential you have, and how to overcome some of the limitations you've learned so that you're able to really experience this and bring about more of what you really want in your life. And not just physical things, but things really much more like joy and stillness and peace.
So you're teaching wellness, which we know anyhow, you're teaching wellness, not illness management. And that's a whole different mind shift.
Yeah, that's very different. And this workshop will not be so much focused on health per se, although there's no way, I can't mention it as part of my experience, and there's no way that in fact if people really do access their heart, either by experiencing more joy or meditation, that they're not going to be healthier and happier.
I don't know if you meet people like I meet. I meet a very wide spectrum of people. I'm sure you meet a wide spectrum too. I meet many people who tell me something very interesting. They say, I don't know how to feel. Have you heard this before?
Yeah, I would say, and I don't want to stereotype males, but I think that's our natural experience, and maybe I would even go so far as to say it's part of our natural heritage, that it's within our DNA. You know, when John Gray wrote his book, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, you know, some people laughed about it, but I think there's real wit and wisdom in his book, and that men and women are genuinely different, and that's kind of funny to even say. But women tend to be much more relationship-oriented and emotional, and how people feel. And men, on the other hand, are very goal-oriented and problem-solvers and, you know, don't really want to go near their feelings. And, of course, that's part of the social conditioning for many is, you know, like the idea, if you want to cry, I'll give you something to cry about. You know, we're just not encouraged to be in touch with our feelings, or we're sissies, or, you know, if you want to act like your sister, you know what I mean? So it's just part of, I think, either the way we're wired or certainly reinforced by our conditioning many times.
Can this be changed? Can people?
Oh, no question it can be changed. No question it can be changed. It doesn't mean you may not have to really work at this, but positively it can be changed. In fact, I woke up this morning with that in my brain, that this can be changed, because I've been working on a special issue of my own. And that was so strong, and I've worked at it so long, I know theoretically it can be changed, but it was more telling me, you know, keep this up and you really can change this. So yes, there's no question in my work and all of my training and experience that you can change something, but it you may have to really discipline yourself and apply yourself.
That makes a lot of sense. If for anybody listening to us right now and thinking, I'd love to be able to feel. You don't have to tell us who you are, okay? We don't need to know that. That's fine. You know yourself what you're going through. Please keep this conversation to heart. Remember what Dean is saying, because this could change your life, truly. Once you start to feel, life opens up. Even if it doesn't feel good all the time, The magic in life is when you feel. Would you agree with that?
Right. In fact, it brings up the concept of mindfulness. And now there's actually a great deal of research showing that mindfulness can have tremendous benefits in terms of people's health and happiness. But mindfulness is about being fully present in the moment. And I call it the perfect act of loving yourself. It's accepting yourself just the way you are, unconditionally, so that if you're feeling rotten, the idea is just focus on and be fully present with that you're feeling rotten. And I had to really get used to this whole concept in that it could really work because, remember, my work was on guided imagery and hypnosis that says you only focus on what you want, not what you don't want. So it's fascinating to me that these are really quite opposed to each other, and yet they work beautifully. And I think it's because in mindfulness, we really are loving in that process. And so if you will be in touch with your feelings, whatever they are, even again, if they're negative as such, and it's illogical to think, well, if I just focus on feeling crummy, you know, how is that supposed to make things better? But I think when we send love to ourselves and treat ourselves like a best friend, how would you treat a best friend who is depressed? You know, you wouldn't smack them and say, snap out of it. You would be present with that person. Even if you didn't know what to do, the idea is, I'm going through this with you. It'd be there for your friend, be there for yourself. Love yourself. I think this is huge, and mindfulness is a great way to do that. So back to your idea of encouraging people to be in touch with their feelings, I think it's fantastic if people would stop, pause whenever they're feeling out of sorts, and just be with that part. And even more, send love to that part, like we would, again, a best friend or a child or our own child. And it's remarkable how that can soften the negative stuff, whether that's anger or depression, whatever.
I can confirm what you're talking about. This summer when my dog had passed away, I'd been a caregiver for 8.5 years, starting with my mother. She fell in December of 2006, had a catastrophic head injury that turned into the dementia that killed her. So while that was going on, my father's sister also had dementia, so I had two with dementia at one time. Then I went through all these deaths and losses, then I had the stroke, then Layla got sick. So 8.5 years later, there was nobody to care for. So I made a decision this summer to do something that many people didn't understand. I decided to feel lousy because I needed to go through this. I needed to know, how does it feel to not have your dog, to not have family anymore, to be on your own? And rather than sugarcoat it, when people would say, how are you doing? I would say, I'm doing lousy and I'm supposed to. And they would look at me like I was insane. But I knew that by doing this, I was a trailblazer. I was teaching them that it's okay to own your feelings. Does that make sense to you?
It makes sense to me, but more importantly, it makes sense to you. You know, rather than, you know, there's this formula, you know, and everybody should do this, think this, feel this, is to be patient with ourselves and be patient with others in their readiness to move forward. You know, knowing what you know now, you didn't believe that before. And so there is an important concept of readiness that we have to be, you know, maybe more gentle with ourselves. In this process of learning and unfolding and understanding ourselves in a way that makes sense to us. So I'm glad for you that it is working for you. It certainly conforms with what I've learned. But again, I think we need to respect other people's awareness level at that time and what they're ready to do and trust. I think this is huge, but I believe this completely because of what I know about quantum physics and also about what I believe is the core of who we are, is that however some might say let go, let God, I'm convinced of the value of getting out of our own way. And so while I certainly am prepared to teach people different techniques to increase the odds that they're going to feel better, like mindfulness, whatever, is I don't know if I could say something that's more beneficial than truly trusting in this, whether we call it quantum field or the love that totally surrounds and supports us. And I even think of this Star Wars image where Darth Vader is saying that there's a disturbance in the field. Well, that disturbance is us. This field is one of complete harmony. Darth Vader wouldn't have seen it that way, but it's one of complete harmony. And it's when we resist it in any way by being out of alignment with the qualities of love and the underpinnings of the universe that we restrict the flow of this loving, supportive energy.
You know, I have to ask you, what got you started on the road to healing with love? What in your life propelled this for you?
Well, honestly, I guess it would really have to go back to the 70s when I attended a self-help course with a fellow named Ken McCauley. And we soon became really great friends, and even then business partners and roommates, and worked very closely together. I totally changed my life because of what I was learning about guided imagery and how we could change learned limitations, all the conditionings from earlier in life. And it turned out that he had been psychic all of his life, and when we would meditate, which we did daily, at some point he began to channel. And I had the experience where I was able to talk to an inner wisdom that some might call a guardian angel, a spirit guide, or his higher self, or we were actually told who this awareness was. They either called themselves mentors or master teachers, but every day, Cheryl, for 7 years, I spoke with this wisdom, and that totally changed my life. It was this wisdom, actually, that encouraged me to go back to graduate school so that I would be able to teach this, and I remember they're saying, and getting the credentials that I earned would open doors that otherwise wouldn't be open for me. So that's what really started me. There wasn't anything they said that ever wasn't about the importance of living love. So that was my first introduction, to be certain. And then the more I read about this kind of thing, and then, of course, as I got into my own work and research with cancer and then Dean Ornish's work and so forth, there was no way that this wasn't real. And I felt compelled to share it with others, to tell them there's more you can do. And a lot of people like it because it actually correlates with their religious or spiritual beliefs. And so it's kind of fun for me to support what many people already believe, that, yeah, when you live love, it is probably the happiest and healthiest you will ever be. And I would say the wisest thing you could ever do when you understand that all of your thoughts and all of your feelings go through your body and are broadcast out of your body. You know, what energy do you want going out into the universe, creating the universe? And the only thing that makes sense is love, joy, peace.
That's brilliant, and I'm glad you said that. It's true. It does come right down to that, doesn't it?
Well, it's what I've come up with. It makes great sense to me.
I'm in with you. I'm sure we have other people who are in with you as well. I can see we're getting maybe 8 minutes away from the end of the show, and I want to make sure that I talk about, if people visit your website, deanchirok.com, that they can come away with a free 6-part class on Why Love Heals. Could you talk about that class that you offer to people?
Yeah, thank you. Yes, I'm very pleased to offer that. If they just go to my website again, deanchirok.com, they can see right away on the front page that I give away a guided imagery exercise they can download on Why Love Heals, as well as a 6-part e-course on Why Love Heals, just for signing up, just saying, yes, I would like this, and we will send it out immediately. And yes, I hope they will go to my website and at least become more aware of what I have learned and believe. And there are numbers of brief videos so people can also have a sense of who I am and what I teach. And there's actually a very good interview that's about a half hour long, if people want to listen that long, by a French journalist named Lilou. And that's actually how Baptiste de Pop heard about me, was actually seeing that video on my website. So yes, I hope people will go there, and however, might gain some additional insight into improving their lives in some way.
That's a terrific video. I have watched that, and I highly recommend. Please visit his website and view the video. And even if it doesn't seem relevant to your life in this moment, maybe you'll have the same experience I had. Somewhere in your consciousness, you'll remember this conversation. You'll remember that video. You'll remember something. And at some point in your life, it will come forward and help you to create a whole different reality.
Good.
Well, what else can I say? Now, let me ask you also, you have wonderful listening skills, really terrific. Have you noticed that it's not necessarily popular to listen anymore because there's cell phones and there are computers and lots of distractions? So we found it socially acceptable to kind of listen to people. You know, it's okay to text while you're talking to somebody. It's okay to take a call while you're talking to somebody. How do we listen? How do we learn to listen again, listen meaningfully, so the people in our lives feel loved and supported?
Well, I think at some point, maybe it's thrown in our face a bit so that we're challenged with it, that if our partner or our spouse or someone we love or want to be in good relationship with, you know, just points out to us, hey, you're not listening. Maybe that will be enough of an impetus to get them to do that. But I honestly believe that for a great number of people, Cheryl, they have this fear of intimacy, a fear of openness and honesty, because their life experience has been one of, if they are open and honest and share what they really believe and how they really feel, is they might experience rejection of some kind. And I would say that it is probably the experience of almost everyone. And so at a subconscious level, then people don't want to really open their heart because they've had some negative experiences and don't want to risk that. And what if people reject who I really am, what I really believe? That's devastating. So I think it goes beyond the discourtesy or what seems like people not communicating well by using their cell phones and not connecting more in a very heartfelt way, in the way people really communicate, because I know when you do that, there's really good research showing how if people would really learn to truly communicate with their hearts, it may be as great an antidote for heart disease as anything. And that's certainly supported by the research of a psychologist named James Lynch, and then followed up by the research of Dean Ornish. So I think that it's something that eventually we just have to learn, however we come to understand how important it is. I mean, even if in just playing fair, if you want to be listened to, then it just makes sense that you play fair and listen to others.
Dean, can you believe the hour is up already?
Okay.
I didn't want to shut you up. No, I'm so glad you were here. And Dean has agreed to come back in 2 weeks for the next episode of Catalytic. We're going to continue the conversation. And I can't wait. I always love speaking with you. I always learn so much. Please visit the website. Could you give us the link again for your website?
Sure. www.deanschrock.com. And I just had this thought, but I don't know. I'll just have to give Baptiste a call. But he's always traveling around the world, you know, promoting the power of the heart. But maybe I can even get him to slow down long enough to join us in our next conversation.
That would be fabulous if you could do that. Thank you. So we'll see what happens in 2 weeks. My name is Cheryl Hirsch-Kramer, thanking you for joining us on the premiere episode of Catalytic Radio. So now, what do you do when life happens? You know, to get catalytic. Thanks for being with us tonight. Many blessings.